Red Hills for me has improved hugely over the last few years, and the commitment is fantastic. They do a really good job. It's not easy. They work fantastic with the city there, and it's great. The city's really behind it. They maintain the park during the year, and there's a great relationship that they have with the city, and long may it continue.
Welcome to the Major League Eventing Podcast, the show for eventing fans by eventing fans.
And as usual, we'd like to thank our sponsor, Mane & Tail, Karen. We love Mane & Tail.
We love Mane & Tail.
We absolutely love Mane & Tail. You know who else loves Mane & Tail, Karen?
Caroline Martin.
Caroline Martin. Caroline is on with us.
I think I'm the number one fan, to be honest, guys. I swear, I've been using the product since I was 7 years old. And they're actually a local company where I live in Pennsylvania. So they really have a special place in my heart. And people would not believe the amount of products they make. You know, you always think Mane and Tail, the shampoo and conditioner. Well, they make Detangler. They make this killer shine-on spray that makes a horse's coat look amazing. They have spray and braid. They have everything. You don't have to go anywhere else to buy products. They're affordable. They're a family-run company. Like, and they're just the nicest group of people. So I could not think of a better company to go out and support. So if you have a horse, please only buy Mane & Tail. They go above and beyond, and they give back so much to the community. So they're honestly the best company I've ever worked with. So
we love them.
Yeah, we absolutely.
And that's all I use.
Yep,
that's what gives me my shine in my hair. So
Caroline, do you use it in your own hair?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes, I use it in your own hair. I use it. All right.
Even our dogs use it.
Even our dogs, absolutely. Well, we have one dog with really bad hair, Caroline, so he uses the Pro-Tech line stuff because he has bad coat. So it fixes him right up. Yep. So
see? Just another benefit of Mane & Tail. They make anything you need. So
absolutely.
And nothing with tests, nothing with drug tests. They just go above and beyond.
They are the best. So all right. Well, thanks a lot, Mane & Tail. And thank you, Caroline, for joining us for that little spot.
We are excited about the $50,000 LiftMaster Grand Prix eventing at Bruce's Field on March 5th and 6th. There will be entries from all of the elite USEF high-performance riders, including USEA Rider of the Year and undefeated Grand Prix eventing champion Liz Halliday-Sharp. There will be live stream by Horse & Country TV showing the five-star dressage, show jumping by Olympian Michelle Valancourt, and cross-country designed by Captain Mark Phillips. For more information, go to aikenhorsepark.org/eventing.
Taylor Harris Insurance Services. There for all equestrians, amateur and the professional. For all types and all breeds. No matter what discipline or level, Taylor Harris is committed to excellence in serving you and protecting the horses you love. Taylor Harris Insurance Services, your worldwide equine insurance specialists.
I'm Karen.
And I'm Rob. Karen, we're still international.
The month
of international guests, we've been going all over the world lately. And today, we're there again.
Yes, we are.
Over the pond, across the pond again, Karen, with international world-class, been there, done that, course designer, Mike Etherington Smith.
Welcome.
Mike, welcome to the show.
Hi, guys. Yeah, good to chat.
Yeah, so this is really cool. Red Hills, Mike is, may I call you Mike? I feel like I should call you like Mr. Like, is Mike okay?
I answer to anything. Okay. Or I've been called plenty of things over the years. So yeah.
It's all right. No, I'm sure all kind thing.
Yeah, not all polite.
Our friends over at Red Hills helped get Mike on with us. Mike is course design in Red Hills. Mm-hmm. We're going to get into that a little bit more. So just wanted to thank those guys over at Red Hills, right,
definitely,
Karen?
Definitely, yes.
So, Mike, just before we get started, where are you coming to us from?
I was sitting in the UK, and it's a bit chilly at the moment, but it's fine, and we're lucky. The other side of the country's got snow, so.
you're on the dry side.
We're fine. I'm sort of sitting in the house, just basically doing what I can, really, by way of planning for this year and doing things. And I get a coronavirus jab tomorrow. Just been fixed.
Oh, good for you.
Yeah.
Good for you.
That's because I'm old enough to get it.
Is this one of two shots or is this a single
shot? Two shots. First shot tomorrow.
Gotcha. And you guys are pretty locked down as of right now, right?
Well, we are. I mean, we're lucky we're out in the countryside. And, you know, we're in the middle of the country here, where we are here and in a village on the edge of the Cotswolds. And so pretty much life is carrying on as normal. You know, we're pretty self-contained. We've got the horses here and, you know, if there's shopping to be done, we can go and do that. But, yeah, no, it's kind of weird being home for so long. And Sue hasn't thrown me out of the house yet, which is a relief. But I have to say it's really rather nice. I'm getting used to not going up and down the M40 to Heathrow or Birmingham airports, which is a well-trodden path. So it's really nice to be home for a bit, I have to say. Oh, although I'm ready to rock and roll again.
Yeah, well, that was the next question. Yeah. Is are you getting that comfortable or are you ready to go? Sue's about to kick him out. Sue's like, Sue might have another amp. We'll bring Sue in next. We'll say, how's it going with Mike home all this time?
Yeah, no, she's banned from joining in on this conversation. She's
Get out of here. Oh, so Mike, before we get into the whole cross country design, can you take us back and tell us how you actually got your start into horses?
Oh gosh, that's a long time ago now. Wow. Yeah, I mean, I used to sort of started off with a bet. My mum used to ride a little bit. I got two younger sisters and they rode a little bit. And in those days, I thought, well, yeah, you know, girls go riding and you know, just leave it at that. And it's not something the boys really did. So I had a bet, and one of my sisters had a bet with me that I couldn't stay on for half an hour. And so I thought, okay, I'm always up for a bet. I'm a mug. I'm always up for a challenge, whatever that is. We have a theory in the family. If you've seen it on the telly, you know how to do it, which is absolute rubbish. And it's quite highly dangerous as well, but that's what we do. And so so that's how I got into it. And I stayed on, and I won my, I don't know, bottle of orange squash or whatever it was. And then stuck with it. And a mate of mine was in the pony club. And he said, why don't you come to the pony club? I said, what do I want to come to the pony club for God's sake? You know, this is crazy. You know, I'm doing all, so I was into sports, all sorts of sports, played a lot of tennis, played a lot of cricket, rugby, soccer, all sorts of stuff. And he said, oh, you want to come along? I said, he said, you would be the third bloke and the rest of them are all girls. And, you know, sort of a hormonal 14, 15-year-old, it sounds quite exciting, doesn't it? And so... So lo and behold, I mean, I started going on the pony club, and I was the oldest in the bottom right by a long shot. I was sort of quite tall, and those little kids.
He didn't tell you all those little girls. All those girls were littler than you, right?
Well, yeah, he's 6 and 7 year old kids, and here was I, sort of 14 years old. Or whatever. A bit of a prat, don't you? Anyway, it's so I started on that, and actually, what I really got into was tetrathlon.
Oh, very cool.
And that led into pentathlon. Mm-hmm. And I got on a national squad for that. And then my mum very kindly bought another horse, which I started doing a little bit of eventing on. Never really into dressage very much. You know, I'm not sure many boys really are at that stage, are they? And got into a bit of eventing. And that's how that started. And then I got left 500 quid in a will. And so I bought a horse. Sold it, made a little bit of money, bought another one, sold it, made a little bit of money, bought another horse, won a 3-day event, sold the horse, and I was asked to keep the ride and become a competition rider in a yard. So rather than going to Loughborough University, which is what I was supposed to do, to read French and business studies, I ended up just mucking around with horses. I had a year off. I was going to have a year off between school and university anyway. And that's when I was, you know, buying and selling these horses and won this 3-day event, as I say. And I thought, well, this horse lot's quite easy, really. how wrong was that? Anyway, so I didn't go to university and just ended up, because I got offered the chance to become a competition rider, eventing and jumping, in what was quite a big yard at the time. That's how I got going. And from that, at that stage, we also got into organising an event. The place where we were based had an event, and they said, will we organise it? So I said, yeah, fine. And that started our organisational stuff. It's where I met Sue. And then in organizing, I got a little bit into designing. And actually, while I was in Pony Club, I was doing a little bit of designing as well, just out of interest, a bit of building. Wow. And so it sort of just grew from that, really.
Yeah.
And then it seeped into slightly more professional stuff. I competed professionally. I was one of the early professionals eventing and show jumping or eventing in this country. And so I did that for quite a long time. And while I was doing that, I was doing a bit of course designing. But mainly producing young horses. I got the odd horse that, you know, kept through to the top level, which was fun. But I rode many, many different sorts of horses, which undoubtedly was a huge help in the course designing side of things. Because good horses will always find it easy. The not so talented horses will always find it more difficult. And if you can have an understanding of the challenges that the less athletic horses face, that really helps with the design side of things. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, I was then starting to, I had a syndicated horse and I was sort of riding part-time, trying to do it part-time as I got involved with British Horse Trial Association, as it was then, as a technical advisor, which is where you go around lots of events advising organisers on the running of their event and with particular emphasis on the cross-country courses. And so I was trying to ride part-time and I was halfway around badminton. I thought, for God's sake, Michael, just give up. You're riding like an amateur. So I finished the competition, and I thought that was enough. And it was a good time to retire that particular horse. As I say, it was syndicated, it's a lovely horse. And so thereafter, I got into the design side, and so it escalated from there, really.
Wow, wow. Mm-hmm. Couple of cool things, Karen. Yeah. Number one, tetrathlon.
Right.
We love tetrathlon. Yeah. Many people don't know what it is. Maybe people in Pony Club do, but Karen actually brought tetrathlon to our region and our pony club, which is pretty cool.
I was an
cool
organizer in our area.
She ran that for years and years, and now it's...
That grows into pentathlon as well, doesn't it?
Yeah. It does, yeah.
So we only got into fencing. That was the tricky bit.
Yeah. Well, we didn't have much of the fencing because we stayed with the pentathlon or the tetrathlon side with the no fencing. Mm-hmm.
Our oldest son, he was big in tetrathlon. And one year at championships, he won a scholarship to the Olympic training facility in Colorado, right? And that's where he learned fencing and, you know, got a lot of good tips for everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We had some good local, we had a couple local Olympic pentathletes come out of like our
area.
Yeah. So
brilliant. It's a great sport. I mean, now, of course, it's much more athletes who ride who come at it from that side of things, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I always feel sorry for the guys you see the Olympic Games. It's a luck of the draw. They can have some dog of a horse to ride, can't they? Which could actually all the hard-earned points that they got before just go straight out the window because they ride some food. And, you know, it's kind of tough, but that's the game, isn't it? I mean, it's the luck of the draw, really. That it's not a lot of it's not necessarily to do with skill in the riding bit in that element, is it really? I don't think.
Yeah, for people who don't know pentathlon, it's like a catch ride. So I think they draw a horse, they get like 15 minutes to warm up and away they go.
Yeah. And I mean, how organizers manage to find, well, they struggle, don't they, to be honest, enough good horses for these guys to ride. I mean, it's a nightmare to try and find them.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can just end up with some catch ride that's pretty useless or pretty hopeless. Bless it. It does its best, but it's not very good necessarily.
Right.
It's a bit frustrating, but hey, there you go. It's kind of fun.
Yeah.
And tetrathlon, for anyone at home that's listening, they have maybe young people and they want to, you know, incorporate more, you know, physical, athletic type of stuff. Tetrathlon's, you know, running, swimming, shooting.
Yep.
So it's much more, you know, including the horseback riding. So it's a lot more of an all-around athlete than just the riding. So if you want to get your kids out there running a little bit and getting them outside off the horse and running, that's a great sport for them.
It's also great for getting boys into the Pony Club, or just get them riding, get them interested.
It sure is.
I mean, that's how I came into it, and that's how some mates of ours came into it. It's how our children got into it, and, you know, their mates. So, awesome. It's a good way.
Yeah.
Riding boys, let's put it that way. You know?
And it's funny, you mentioned you took a gap year from college. We just the other day saw a young lady that's a friend of ours. You know, we've seen her come up and through Pony Club and things. And she's in her gap year, Mike. She's in her gap year, and they just imported a nice warm blood. And I said, that doesn't look like a girl taking a gap year. That looks like more than one gap year.
It's quite a high risk, isn't it? Yeah. But there's a tipping point, isn't there, really, between when parents think, you know what, guys, you've got to sort of start standing on your own 2 feet. The bank of mum and dad has to run out at some stage. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and particularly we see it with lots of girls. They understandably, you know, they start off and then they fall in love, go get married. So the interest wanes. There's a tipping point, isn't there? Sort of around about 22, 23, 24, 25. Because college comes along, boyfriends come along. And, you know, it's like in any sport, you've absolutely got to be 100% dedicated with no distractions. And I always see it here in sport over here, you know, a lot of people come through. And also the step from young riders to seniors is massive, as we know. And it's a big, big step, you know, and everybody thinks, well, it's not, you know, talented riders, but actually when you start playing with the big boys, it's a different league, isn't it?
Yeah. It's funny. We interviewed Buck Davidson way early on, and Buck said, you know, when you're a young rider, you know, if you have some money behind you and you could buy really great horses, he says, but, you know, once you get to the top of the sport, everybody's got money, you know, and meaning, you know, whether it be syndicates or, you know, all the horses generally are going to be well-bred, pretty, you know, expensive horses. So then it's, it's not so easy, you know, much easier when you're a junior and mom and dad are footing the bill.
Yeah, I mean, well, if being a professional in any sport is tough. It's tough and it's hard work. Getting there is one bit. I mean, these guys who manage to stay at the top, and you look at somebody like Bruce Davidson, I mean, brilliant. And the O'Connors, you know, they get there and they stay there on so many different horses and different types of horses. And that's when you find out, you see that the true classy guys, you know, the Todds of this world, the Tates of this world, the Starks, the Lucinda Greens, the Ginny Lings, they're all brilliant. And now we're seeing the next wave, aren't we? Which is great. I mean, the Fox Pitts, the Mary Thompsons, I mean, there aren't that many of them at any one time, and they're in a different league. Yeah. You know, there's those guys, and then there's the rest of people like me.
Right. Now, how old were you when you decided to stop riding, like, competitively?
Second half of my 20s. I was making a living out of it. But I've got a wife, two young children. I thought, you know what, you look at your mates, or people who've been in the sport for a long time, they either get beaten up because they have bad falls or whatever, or they end up going teaching and coaching, which I didn't really want to do. And at the time, lots of people, you know, they couldn't even afford to buy their own houses, you know, because the rewards weren't that great. I mean, it's all changed in the last 20 years, 30 years. I didn't fancy any of that, so I thought the best thing to do is get involved in the admin side of the sport.
Wow.
It's a passion. I love the sport. And I was lucky enough to get the breaks. And I got my first break as far as designing an international event in the mid-80s at Bremen. I did my first 3-star CCI, which is now 4-star CCI, 4-star long, in 1986 or 87 or something. So all this gray hair, I've been around for a while.
Well, I think that's really interesting. Like, you know, because we, you know, it is, I think it's really refreshing to hear, okay, you know, I was riding, I loved it, I did really well, I was competing at a high level. But, you know, to hear your thought process and to know that, hey, look, there is other career paths and that are maybe a little less dangerous, you know, but still in the sport.
You don't worry about risk. If you worried about risk, you wouldn't do it.
Right.
I mean, the only way to make proper money out of the sport is actually to produce horses, really, and sell them on. And, you know, we never had the backing to be able to buy our own horses, which is why I had some cracking owners, some brilliant owners over the years. But I mean, that was just a way of, the only real way to make proper money. And I just didn't fancy that. I mean, neither sooner or I fancy doing that. So, it was a tough way to earn a living, for sure. And we were lucky. I mean, neither of us got bashed up too badly. You know, old nose getting away a few times. Fingers and ribs, but I mean, nothing serious, you know, a few concussions, but you don't count those, do you?
No, that's collateral damage. Oh. Do you still ride at all, or like, do you have any horses? Or do you
if it's a nice day, it's sunny, I mean, no, not really. I've got very little interest in going for a ride, to be honest. I mean, the grandchildren, we got two ponies, two of the grandchildren here. It's great going out riding with them. And sometimes I go out for a ride with Sue. So we've got a horse that I can ride. It's a load bearer. And, you know, so we just go. I mean, hacking around here is beautiful. But it's, I don't really have any. If there's a competition or there's a bet, then I'd be doing it like a shot. And a few years ago, our eldest son, who invented, and he's designing tracks now and things as well, he had a horse, but he was running an event, and he said, "Dad, you're on a ride, Big Ed," which is his horse. So I said, "Well, if it's a sunny day and somebody plats it up and, you know, comes along and helps, then yeah, why not?" He said, "Well, you're going to have a practice." So I said, no, let's just jump on and have a bit of sport. This is 25 years after I'd stopped. I'd ridden about 3 times in those 25 years.
Oh, my goodness.
The most difficult thing to do was actually learn the dressage test.
How about that? So
the rest was fine, and I came second. How weird is that?
Now, the next day, how easy was it to get out of bed?
Oh, it's fine, actually.
Really?
And I run quite a lot, bike quite a lot. I mean, I did try and keep myself fairly fit. And, when the sun came out in the morning, I thought, I'm not sure if this is a good thing or a bad thing. Because, you know, if it had been pouring with rain, I wouldn't have even got on. You know, I'm not too old to ride in the rain. And, through choice. The sun came out, bloody hell, I'm going to have to ride now. So. And then same thing up the following year. He said, "You want to ride Ed again?" So I said, "Yeah, okay, if the sun shines, same deal as last year." Da-di-da-di-da. I think, well, sun's not going to come out 2 years in a row. and I screwed it up the next year. Oh. I came around a corner too tight and asked the horse to do something it couldn't do.
On cross country?
Yeah. Oh. Yeah.
Rookie move. Rookie mistake.
Everybody had a good laugh. Anyway, that was amazing. They said, fart's trying to kill himself or something. it's not too serious.
That is funny. So, well, I mean, you literally wrote the book on eventing, or, you know, cross-country course design. It's a cross-country course design and construction.
So that's all.
Yeah. Gosh,
you've been doing some homework. Yeah.
It's still available.
Well, it's a bit out. It does need updating, and it needs somebody younger to come out with one. The trouble is, I mean, they're never going to be bestsellers, are they? If you're a publisher, you know, you're on a bit of a high need to nothing. The publisher, they had an option to ask me to update it by a certain date. Anyway, they missed that date. Because I'm not good at sitting down and writing. I find it really, really hard to do. And it got, the end of it was just as frangible devices are coming into the sport. And so there's a whole chapter now that needs bringing. I mean, it's like anything, it does need updating. It needs somebody. It was 20 years old now, that book.
Are there any, off the top of your head, are there any, jumps that today you wouldn't see on a cross-country jump like that were in that book that today you wouldn't see on course?
Well, I haven't looked at the book for a long time. But there are certain fences that, for sure, I wouldn't be brave enough to design that I was designing 20, 30 years ago nowadays, because I think people would have an absolute fit. And looking back at some of the things we used to jump, the size of the timber, the profiles of the fences, I mean, nowadays they would be deemed to be unacceptable, which for me is a big thing. I think that's a shame. I think this, we'll maybe come on to that in a bit, I think, some horsemanship skills that have disappeared over the years. Not through anybody's fault, just because the way the sport developed and then had to take a half halt and actually rewind a little bit. So, but there are some fences, you know, I walk around, you know, when I go to badminton, I look at some of these things that we jumped. Bloody hell, how the hell did we jump those things? They'd never be allowed nowadays. Not that they were bad fences, but I mean, just, I think there's, everything's moved on.
Yeah.
And, you know, pull out some old photos. Occasionally people say, "Oh, have you got any old photos? You can show us some of the jumps in the olden days." And yeah, sure. And they say, "Gosh, did you really jump this sort of stuff?" Yeah, sure. that was the sport then. But then there was a period when everybody, you know, we had the fatalities over here in 1999, which was really sad. And so there's a big thing. Okay, what do we do to make the sport safer? And there was a drift towards bigger timber at the time. And much softer profiles, which in theory was a very good thought process. But what it meant was that people went faster, a little bit faster, and also the fences became more forgiving, so that people were getting away with things which they wouldn't have got away with before, and the horses, some horses' jumping techniques weren't good enough for the top level. So it's, that's what I mean, where some of the horsemanship skills have disappeared. It's nobody's fault. But because we were making these softer profiles and using bigger timber, we then made a conscious decision that we'd actually have to rewind and go back a little bit. And years ago, I convened a meeting over here, and we got all the course designers and technical advisors in the room, about 70 people in the same room, you know, from grown-up course designers to people who are just starting. And we said, okay, what's the future of course design? Where do we want to go with this? And I remember Lucy Wiegersmark, you know, she said at the meeting, good for her, she said, you know, I get more excitement out of going for a day's hunting than I do of going around badminton. Wow. And she said, you know, the whole sport is becoming sanitized. You know you're going to be a skinny, you know you're going to have this, you know you're going to have it, you know you're going to have this. It's all just a question of how it's all presented and jumbled up. And it was a very fair point, because at the time, you know, that's what everybody was doing by way of course design. So that made everybody have a bit of a rethink. And so we rewound things a little bit and made a conscious decision to go to smaller materials again, jump more open corners, more open oxes rather than solid top corners, solid top oxes and that sort of thing. So that because people will respect them more, inevitably. Go back to slightly deeper water because water had become so shallow that people were disrespecting it. And were going, they were jumping into water jumps much faster than they would have done in the olden days when water was a bit deeper and had an influence. If you went in too fast, you know the chances are you might get a swim. Mm-hmm. Not that that's what course designers were setting out to do, but you know you had to respect the fences a bit more. And so we made the effort, conscious decision, to try and rewind things, to try and bring back some of these horsemanship skills in the sport. And to a degree, I think it's worked, but inevitably the change, you know, with no race and tracks and steeplechase anymore, has changed the sport as well. And it's a different skill set that's required now.
Yeah. That's really interesting that you say all that you just said is like my brain is just like processing, you know, because I think of all that. You know, we live just outside of Fairhill and we hike there all the time. And you know, the Maryland Five Star, the new side is all brand new cross country. But then there's where the Fairhill International side is, you know, they ran there 20 years ago, and you could still see a lot of the old elements still there. All the old jumps are still there, and just you could just tell where the track has changed and moved, and you could see a lot of these old, you know, multiple steps, the step jumps up the hills, and you could see how the evolution of the sunken road, because you know further down from the current sunken road is some of the older sunken road stuff, and you could definitely see the evolution of the sport mm-hmm. as you walk through there. It's very interesting.
Yeah, I TD'd there quite a few times, a long time ago now, so I'm very familiar with the site. I also I was asked if I'd submit a proposal for the new five star, which I didn't do. So I'm familiar with Fairhill, and I mean, they used to steeplechase on the old race course there.
Yeah.
You know, in those days, Rosen tracks went out, came back, and yeah. And I mean, the last Olympic Games, which I was lucky enough to do, was Sydney, where there's Rosen tracks and steeplechase. And then, of course, that all changed. And I suppose, inevitably, therefore, the rest of the sport would follow suit at some stage. Which is, of course, what happened.
Yeah. And I noticed the water getting deeper, and I didn't realize, you know, I just never put it together that would be a conscious decision to back people down a little bit. And we saw that at Tryon at the last event. I think it was the fork at Tryon. We saw a lot of people jumping into the water. The water was a little deep, mm-hmm. and we saw a number of people popping off there. And I wonder if that's just a consequence of the deeper water and coming in too hot, I guess.
Could well be. And I mean, if you look at, you know, the old traditional coffin fences, even at some of the higher levels, we've gone now towards, rather than just having a log as the first element, you know, go for postal rails or that sort of thing, because it makes people just back up a little bit more. I remember at Badminton many years ago now, Wolfgang Felt was TD and Hugh was designing it. And we were just having a chat during cross country day, and Wolfgang said, he said, I thought we'd done the steeplechase before, because these guys are swinging on down to this coffin, going so fast into it. I said, bloody hell. So how are we going to slow these guys down? Because I mean, they're just going in too quick. And of course, these are the top level riders, and they know the horses, they're experienced horses, but it's the lower level riders who think that's the way to ride a coffin.
Right.
And not. You know, they can do it because they have that level of expertise. but it's, you know, it's not good for people to copy these things, you know, and inevitably people copy their stars, don't they?
Sure.
They follow their stars and think, oh, that's how you do it, is it? And then when it doesn't quite work out, they think, oh, what went wrong there? you know, it's a bit like course designing. You know, that people think that, oh, I'm going to copy a fence. You know, I did Kentucky for many years. And I saw it in the States a bit. I said, okay, well, I'm going to put one of those and one of those and one of those on my prelim course. Do you think that's a good idea? I said, no. You know, you cannot. A question on a five-star track, just because it's smaller, doesn't become a suitable question on a prelim track.
Right.
And so, you know, I think, again, you know, people have moved away from that. You can't just pick up an idea from a high-level competition and put it into a low-level one. Whereas there was a bit of a trend at one stage, but I think that's gone now. I think the course designers and officials now are much more educated, which is good, and we're always learning. There's always something new to learn.
Yeah.
Always.
Yeah.
We definitely see a lot of that, a lot of the training. We've had other course designers on. It sounds mm-hmm. like you said, you guys are all getting together and having these discussions and so forth. Where do you see, or do you see a future? Like, do you see the sport in 5 years being much different than what we see today? Especially in cross-country design?
In terms of course design, no, I don't, because I'm not sure there's a lot more we can do. Because we have to be fair to the horses. I mean, I'm much more interested in horses and how they perform than I am in the athletes themselves. It's kind of hard to know where else to go with it. I mean, I know that some people would like to see more short format competitions and do away with the long format ones. Well, for me, that'd be a crying shame because, you know, we see people go around these short format classes far too fast quite often. You put speed guns on them. Sometimes they're going 100 meters a minute between fences. The style of courses has had to change. I mean, horses now get puffed rather than tired, even in the long format ones, because, you know, pretty much any shape or type of horse can manage a 10-minute, 11-minute course, you know, if they're fit enough. Whereas, not every sort of horse could manage rows and tracks, steeplechase rows and tracks, and then a 13-minute cross country. So I think that the opportunities for more different types of horses are there. I'm not sure. Yeah, I would be anti just going to short format. I like the long format because it does at least keep some requirement for some horsemanship skills and in how to manage your horse on its way round. Mm-hmm. Whereas if we go down to 7 or 8 minute courses, I mean, God forbid, I mean, you know, a fat old fool like me could probably stagger around those things. You know, you want the elite to shine, to have the opportunity to shine. And at the moment, the Badmintons, the Kentuckys, the Burleys, the Millions, the Adelaides, the Poes, the Fair Hills now, you know, they're the aspirational events. And I think that we need to keep those skill sets for people to perform at that level. You can't keep ratcheting the common denominator lower and lower and lower. I was really, really annoyed with Giuseppe, in particular, the eventing committee chairman at the time, when the discussion about the Olympic Games was going on. He won't mind me telling you this, because it's quite a well-known fact. We had a good old Barney about it. That when the discussion about the Olympic Games was going on, that's a long, convoluted story, but I said to Giuseppe, I said, look, you will not dumb down the World Games, will you? Because, you know, it's an FEI-owned competition and there's no need to, and all this sort of, we need to keep it at what was then 4-star level and now 5-star level. Anyway, they eventually decided that it needed to fall in line with Olympic standards. I was so cross and so disappointed, so annoyed, because for me that was a completely unnecessary decision to be made. I mean, the reality is, if you're designing a world championships or whatever, I mean, you make it a decent track. We can all make a 3-foot-6 course that nobody can jump around. There's nothing clever in that. You know, call it Olympic format or World Equestrian Games format, it'll still be a decent track. But the principle of dumbing it down, I just think, is completely wrong. You know, we have to make people come up to the standard rather than bring the standard down to meet the people.
Yeah.
And it's a bit like all these qualifications. You know, just because you're qualified doesn't mean anything. And it's a big message that we try to get out all the time. I sit on the FEI Risk Management Steering Group. And we're all saying, you know, listen, guys, this message has got to get out. Just because you're qualified doesn't mean you're ready to go.
Right.
And it's basic. It's fundamental stuff. And, you know, this is where equity ratings are coming in. I know you were talking to Sam the other day. I mean, they're doing a great job in analyzing performance, which feeds us information that we can make recommendations to the event committee on as far as qualifications are concerned. And maintenance of standards and currency of form is just really, really important. Because it's a risk sport, and there's no point in pretending it isn't.
Yeah.
And you know what? How the sport portrays itself is just so important. You know, the pictures, we want good pictures. The pictures that were seen even 20 years ago are no longer acceptable in the minds of the public. Everybody's got these phones now. Everybody's got access to the internet. The sport is much more high profile. It's much more visible. And you know, horse welfare is paramount and number one. It has to be. Quite rightly too.
Yeah.
So the role of the course designer, we're much more mindful of the consequences of what we do and what we deliver on our courses than we have to be.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Man, so much good stuff, Karen.
I know.
I can go on. So question, talking about course design, you know, one of the big topics has been like the flag rules and how that's kind of evolved over the past few years. How's a question, two questions. Number one is that changing the way it must be, but how is that changing the way you're flagging some of these skinnies and corners and things? Are you flagging them differently? And do you think that the new rule is correct in the way it's being applied?
I'll answer your second one because it's quicker and easier. Yes, I think it's much clearer. And I say that it's a really, really difficult rule to write. I mean, I've written rules over the years. And I know how difficult it is to capture the intent in words and put it down on paper. The best way of it, I think it's being explained now as well as it can be. There was an issue last year and which needed sorting out. That's now been addressed. The easiest way to actually educate people is show footage of horses running out and jumping fences or not jumping fences. And when you sit down, you see 10 separate episodes all back to back. You can see exactly that's 15, that's 20, that's clear, that's 15, that's 20. It's immediately obvious, and it's very easy to overthink a lot of this, but I actually think it's been explained as well as it can be. To answer your first question, we're flagging fences slightly differently, nothing to do with the rules, but it's to do with safety, risk management. And it also comes down to what horses see, which is a big pet thing of mine, on how horses read fences. If you look at a simple oxer, for example, you always put two pairs of flags on it, front and back. Mm-hmm. It helps the horses read the front of the fence, which is the most important part of it. And there are other things you can do. With corners now, we're putting flags on the front rail and the back rail. Well, there's obviously one on the apex. Primarily to try and get riders now to jump the corner on the line that you want them to jump them on. Because if you're a rider, you're naturally going to try and get as square on to the front rail of a corner as you possibly can to reduce the chance of a run out. Now, if you then move the rail on the flag on the back rail in a little bit, it makes it much more difficult for athletes to do that. And so they then have to jump the corner how you as a designer want them to jump it, which is you're essentially bisecting a line through the middle of the angle, if that makes sense.
Yeah. You're bisecting like the A, like the A, the hash mark in the A.
Yeah. And so we use flags to try and make sure that people do jump the fence how you want them to jump them. However, you've got to be fair enough to the horses so that you don't confuse them. And there's a classic example. I mean, Hugh won't mind me saying this. Many years ago, Hugh had these short back corners, what we call short back corners, which you're probably familiar with, where the back rail is very short. And he had a double of these things, and it was a morass of flags. You came up to these things, and I'm a great believer that, and it stems from my riding days. For me, the first time you see a fence is the most important time. So I'd always like to walk a course on my own for the first time. And I reckon if I couldn't understand it immediately, there's no way the horse is going to understand it immediately. And it's exactly the same with these short back corners. It was a great idea. It just was too confusing with the flags. And the horses just weren't sure. They couldn't see the way through it. They couldn't read it properly. And Nobody really picked it up at the time. But then when the horse, when you see a horse trying to jump it, you can see they weren't understanding it. And so that's, you know, another lesson learned for everybody who was involved and everybody who was watching. So I think that flags have a place to play, but they're only marking the extremities of the fence, and they're not there to confuse horses or confuse people. It shouldn't be an integral part of making a fence more difficult for a horse to understand, if that makes any sort of sense.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's the first time they're seeing it. So like you say, you walk it and you're looking at it for the first time. That's more the horse's perspective than the rider's perspective.
Yeah, well, that's how I try and keep things very simple and not to overanalyze. I'm my biggest self-critic, or my biggest critic is myself. But I think that if I can't understand it straight away, how's a horse going to understand it? Mm-hmm. And it's like I will never produce a fence that I would not be prepared to try and jump, no matter if it's, you know, a 90-centimeter course or a, you know, five-star track. I reckon that, you know, if I'm not prepared to try and jump it, or I think it's unreasonable, I'll change it. Won't have it. You know, and sometimes when you're designing something, like I'm doing, like various events in Australia and New Zealand that I do, if I get there and it looks like crap, it's unacceptable, I take it out, start again. And that's, sometimes that can be a bit expensive, but, you know, you've got to be able to put your head on your pillow at night as comfortable as you possibly can be with what you put out there. If you're not comfortable with what you put out there, it shouldn't be there. Something needs to change. It's like when you come up to a fence, if you're not happy with it, change it. Very simple. You know, very simple.
Yeah.
This might be a silly question or not an intelligent question. Pardon me if it isn't. But as far as like when you design a course, and I'm sure every facility has different, you know, terrain and things like that, but do you try to make a conscious effort to say, okay, I want so many percentage to be a galloping fence, so much to be a technical fence? You know, do you have that in mind, or is it just however it lays out, like when you see what you have to work with?
It's however it pans out, to be honest. I mean, the lower level, it's all about education, lower levels. You know, I mean, it's sort of, one star, two star, three star is all about education. Three star is a tipping point. You know, four star, five star tends to be more professional territory. There's room, thankfully, for, you know, good one horse riders to get through the grades and through the levels, which is good and quite right. But it changes, doesn't it? The bottom end is purely about education of horse, education of athlete. And then as you go up the level, it becomes more of an examination. You're trying, for me, it needs to be a positive experience. I don't care what the level is. There's always another competition. I've said this, you know, after Olympic Games or World Games or Europeans, it doesn't matter. You want it to be a positive experience, and you want to give the guys the opportunity to show what they can do and are capable of, rather than trying to find out what they can't do mm-hmm. and are not capable of. And it's a thin line of difference. But it's a positive thinking rather than negative thinking. We have to be fair to horses. We mustn't be tricking horses. The questions that we ask, you know, the riders have to work out the answers to at the higher levels. But the bottom end is pretty straightforward stuff. And you can put a course out there and you know that people will make mistakes. You know, they'll have runouts. I mean, a very simple theory is if a rider makes a mistake, you don't want the horse to be punished. That's one of the things that underpins everything I do. Now, it's a very easy statement to make. It's bloody hard to do in practice. You know, if a rider makes a mistake, you don't want the horse crashing and burning. You want it sort of running out or something like that. And so the questions we're now having to ask as course designers is actually the rider's ability to actually ride. We can't go in the days when I was riding, big bold fences were good enough to get a result because we also had Rosen tracks and steeplechase and all that sort of stuff. So time was a big factor. Now, big run and jump fences on their own are not sufficient to separate out those that are on form on the day from those that are not having such a good day. And, you know, horses are like us, I think. You know, some will wake up in the morning and think, God, I feel like crap today. God, it's raining. I've got to go out and do something. That fella's going to come around and want me to go and jump. And, you know, then there are other days where they feel $1 million. And so, you know, you've got to factor all this in. And then, of course, I mean, footing for me is the single most important thing. The quality of the ground, the quality of the footing will determine so much. It doesn't matter if it's pouring with rain or a very, you know, perfect ground. If the ground needs to be good, because then the horses jump in confidence. If they get suspicious, you can do so much damage because they don't trust the ground, they don't jump well, and that's where things go wrong. So, you know, I make no apology. We spend so much time on footing preparation. I mean, it's a bit like Red Hills. I mean, Jane, Marvin, and the team down there spend so much time on preparing the footing, and it's invisible. You know, everybody sees sexy jumps or whatever. They don't realize, and there's no need that they should, just the amount of effort that goes into getting the ground as good as possible so that their horses jump better. And, you know, you can produce the best fences in the world, but if the footing's awful, the fences count for nothing.
Right.
You know, so for me, the groundwork, the ground, the quality of the ground is absolutely right at the top there. Yeah, it's so important. Then you get into flow and balance of the course, and so it goes on. And there are other factors that impact, you know, if you've got television, if you've not got television, so it goes on. I mean, there's all...
I never thought about television being factored in.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, television spectators, flow of spectators. Then you've got to manage the event. You know, you've got to get, you know, if there's a big crash, you've got to get emergency vehicles there. They've got to be all managed and so on. Yeah, there's so many things. Everything you can think of that does impact. You know what I mean?
That's what I love about this. Getting this information that we, you know, it just gets everyone's head thinking. Yeah. You know, we always take what everyone does for granted, you know, and it's nice to get inside the mind of someone who does it and really, you know, I never thought about television. I thought about like EMS getting to where they have to be. Yeah. I mean, that's a big one too. Like, oh geez, how are we going to get medical people across this course? You know, especially when there's someone else on course and so forth. That's.
Yeah. And quite often, you know, if you watch the horse, I mean, I like what's, if the weather's filthy or the weather's nice, always watch the horses in the last 800-900 meters. Because even though they might be tired, you can tell by looking at them whether they're feeling beaten up or whether they're just feeling tired, but they've had a good positive experience. And a satisfying thing from a course designer's point of view is if a horse starts off a little bit suspicious but then grows, this is what you want them to do, is they go around the course. So it's a positive experience. They really benefit from it. And the riders will learn more about their horses and the horses will learn more about the riders. And if you watch them in that last 500, 600, 700, 800 meters over the last three or four fences, you can see whether they've had a good experience or not, just by the way they're going.
Yeah.
And what it's important to know what you're looking at, because we all learn. You're going to learn what horses do with their legs, how their legs work, how they work themselves. You know, what their heads and neck do as they come to a fence or as they land and all this sort of stuff. And
how about that?
Never ended.
Yeah, a good example of that was when Karen O'Connor was on the show, and she was talking about when she rode Theodore O'Connor.
Oh, yeah.
And she's riding around, and then, you know, she's kind of taking a conservative.
He's
a pony in Kentucky. You know, she's riding a conservative. She gets through the head of the lake, and he's like, taking the bit. You know, he wants to go. So she finally, you know, again, it was kind of like, as he went, he got more confident. She got more confidence in him, and then they, you know, put it in.
You can see it. You know, when she did a great round on that. There was a little pony of a horse, wasn't it?
Yeah.
A class horse. And she did a brilliant job with him. As you say, she started off and the little pony grew, you know. And I mean, these fences, you know, decent fences.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was smiling his way around. It was great. Once he got into it, he thought, yeah, I can do this. He had belief.
Yeah. And incredible.
The part was just such a tragic end, wasn't it?
But, it was tragic, but it's fun because then Karen describes it and then you can go back on YouTube still today
and you can see it. Yeah.
It's really, really cool.
Yeah. It brought joy to so many people.
Yeah. For sure. Before we move on, just out of curiosity, two quick things. Number one is, I know it's been COVID. How many, in a normal year, how many events are you going around to course designing and acting as a TD and your other functions? Like how many events a year are you working with?
I gave up TDing a long time ago. I did Athens and I did badminton. I thought, you know what, I've done enough of this TDing. So I gave that up. I gave that up 14 years ago. That took me all over the world and stuff. That's a good question. I probably do now, not that many. I'm going to say 20 events.
Wow.
And I advise other people. I do a lot of mentoring with people in different parts of the world. And Might be 20 events, but you know, sometimes there are two or three classes at those events. And so it's great. I'm very lucky. But I mean, I cut back a lot. I still spend too much time on airplanes. But it's I quit once after the Worlds in 2010 in Kentucky. I thought, you know what, I'd done enough flying around. And so I gave all my jobs away. And then people said, oh, would you come back? So I thought, okay, I'll come back again. And not with no big master plan to do anything significant again. And suddenly I'm doing 2 5 stars and I'm doing this and I'm doing that. I think, wow, how lucky am I, sort of thing, you know. But it's yeah, I mean, it's sort of no master plan. I'm just jolly lucky, really. Born lucky, I suppose. It's, people ask what I do. I just say I muck around in the horse world. You know, I mean, we're all lucky. You know, our horses are our best mates. I mean, to do what I do, you have to love horses, you know, and appreciate them.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's a great life.
That seems like a good life.
Yeah, sure
does. Minus the flying. You know, if you can just... there in a little camper.
It's kind of interesting at the moment because, as you say, COVID times make it a bit more challenging. Like the last event that I designed that I went to was actually Red Hills last year. Because since then, everything that's been cancelled flights have been cancelled. So events have run, but I haven't been able to get to them. Yeah. And so I've been doing stuff remotely, which is what I've been doing at Red Hills this time.
Yeah, can you talk about that? I guess you're doing it remote. Could you tell us about that? And I think like David O'Connor, you're working with him. He's the man on the ground. Is that how this is working?
Yeah. I mean, this is what I did with several people last year because I've got events all over the place, and the venues that I'm familiar with. You know, I work with the builder, I work with the organizer, and if I got another course designer there, I'll work with him or her as well. You know, such as so Red Hills, for example, I'm very familiar with the venue, and there are only so many places you can put combinations of Red Hills. Jane and Marvin, as I said earlier, they've done a fantastic job in opening the place up, got rid of lots of trees, and improved the flow a lot. Because for me, the flow of a course is really, really important, and they've done a super job there. But it makes it kind of interesting, so I can plan the track over here, plan what I want to do, and then I'll send it through and Tyson will budget it and say, yeah, that's so that all they get signed off. Yeah, we can afford to do that. And so I'll then send the stuff to Tyson, Levy, Jane, Marvin, and David, because David does the lower level tracks there. So he fits in around what I want to do. And then it's great having somebody like David there because we were FaceTiming the other day that I explained, we had a couple of chats and, said, okay, this is my thinking for the first water, next water, the next combination, da 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 da. And this is what I like, sort of spread to curving line, doesn't matter what it is in particular. And, you know, he talks the same language, so that's good. So I said, yeah. So off he goes, and they put the fences out, and then we had several sort of FaceTime calls. And he was showing me, so, okay, this is what I got here. You're happy with that? Yeah. Okay, tell me about how much distance we got between the back of the fence and the edge of the water going in and all that sort of stuff. And we talked about it before, so it was all set up. So then he's showing me this combination of the first water. Happy with that? Yeah, fine. Okay, I'll call you back in 10 minutes when he gets to the next one. Oh, so there's ways of doing it. Provided you've got the right level of knowledge and expertise on the ground, it can be done. What it does rely on, though, is I can come up with the overview. It's the final tweaks that make all the real difference. You know, the angles, how you cut the brush, for example, you know, how tight your turning line is. And so what I say to the guys is, if in doubt, just err on the side of caution. But, you know, it's I mean, somewhere like Red Hills, it's an early season event. You know, get the guys feet up in the air, dust off some of the cobwebs from the winter. And that's sort of the underlying purpose of Red Hills. Still got to be jumping. The guys got to jump. I've got a variety of questions, variety of looks to types of fences. But, you know, it's getting people back in the groove. It's not trying to be too smart. And so, you know, that's very much what's going on at Red Hills. And so Dave and I, we had 3 or 4 calls that day just looking at combinations. We got one more call, video call, set up the last combination. I haven't seen it yet. We'll just get a walk through that. Then we'll have another conversation about any dressing issues, fence dressing issues. But I mean, I did that several times last year at different places around the world. And it works. It's not entirely satisfactory, because what you can't do is you can't, when you're sitting doing what we're doing here, you can't actually see the lines. But that's where, if you've got somebody experienced who you can talk to, who speaks the same language, then you can overcome those challenges. You can't do it with somebody who's not experienced.
Now, if this wasn't a COVID year and you were able to travel, what would that travel look like? Like, how much time would you spend there prior to the weekend, being there on the weekend? Or can you tell us how that would go?
I'm using Red Hills as an example. I mean, I did a design trip last year, just to set it, just to, when I was out, when I'm in the States, I popped down there for a day, meet up with Tyson, explain what we want to do, decide if we have new fences that need building, because some might be getting past their sell-by date. And then I come in, I normally fly in on the, depending where we're setting the fences. I mean, last year it actually worked, even though I got to the event, to save a trip, because, I mean, organisers come under extreme financial pressure. Everybody think organisers makes lots of money. They don't. It's a really tough gig running events financially. It's a tightrope. So to save a trip, David goes out, and he put out a lot of my fences last year before I got there. And then I got there on, I think I came in on the Sunday before. And on the Sunday and Monday, just made a couple of tweaks, just so I was happy. And, so last year it was just the design trip and then coming in for the week of the event and then going somewhere else. And so that's what it would have been this year as well. Because, again, having David there, it can save the organisers a flight and a trip. And, you know, I don't need the air miles. And if something like that works, you know, it works for everybody's in everybody's best interest. so it's good. And yeah, I mean, it's good. I think, I mean, Red Hills for me has improved hugely over the last few years. And the commitment is fantastic. They do a really good job. It's not easy. They work fantastic with the city there. And it's great. The city's really behind it. They maintain the park during the year. And there's a great relationship that they have with the city, and long may it continue. Yeah. You know, as with all venues, it has its challenges. I mean, all venues have challenges. There's no such thing as a perfect venue. But they do a great job, and they're determined to make it better every year. And okay, there'll be no spectators this year, but they'll be back better and stronger next year, which is good. And also because it's, as I touched on earlier on, because it's very much a lay public and a sort of non-equestrian public that goes, we're very, very mindful of what they're going to be looking at in terms of safety. Now, I know safety is the number one priority. And quite rightly so. So we use a lot of frangibles. As I say, we had to move a couple of trees or lose a couple of trees that were in the way and a bit, what we thought a bit too risky. And so, you know, it's the way the sport's going, quite rightly too. You know, we're all into frangible devices where we can. And the other thing they've done at Red Hills this year, which I hope, is they've resisted it up to now, which I hope will succeed, is that they finally decided that they're going to run cross country as the last phase, which is good, which is the way that the sport is going for these short format competitions. It's popular with the athletes, and you could say it's actually better for the horses because they don't have to be pulled out once they've gone cross country to go and do the show jumping stadium. And so it's popular, and I think it's the right move for the event. Jane and Barbara, they resisted it for perfectly understandable reasons. If you're an organizer, you know, one of the events we organize over here is at Chatsworth, which is a big state home, and it's great. You know, we have thousands of spectators around the main arena, and we wanted to finish with the show jumping stadium as the last phase because it brings it to a climax in front of this big auditorium with thousands of people watching. Which you don't quite get the same effect when you finish with the cross country last. So you've got the organisers' wishes and the best interest from the sponsor side of things versus what actually the athletes want. And there's a bit of a tug of war in there. But we're all in the sport to do what we can to make people have a good time or allow people to have a good time. So if that's what the athletes want to do, then that's great. Why not? It's we all do it for the athletes.
Gotcha.
Or we actually do. For the horses and the athletes, I mean, that's why, you know, and it's an important point to remember. Everybody does it for people to go and enjoy themselves. It doesn't matter what the level is. You know, it's a hobby, isn't it?
Yeah.
I love it.
You know, It's a living for some, but it's a hobby for most.
Yeah, absolutely. Man, I still have a million questions, but I'm gonna move on. I'm gonna move on because I don't want to.
So we'll just have to look out for your course, Red Hills, March 11th through the 14th.
Yeah, that's gonna be awesome.
Yeah, it's coming up. Cool. Coming absolutely. Up. So Mike, we are gonna play quick fire questions. And this quick fire questions is brought to you by Taylor Harris Insurance Services. So we're gonna ask you five random silly questions, and you don't have to be quick, but we do grade you at the end. So, all right. Favorite course.
You want serious answer, though.
So, favorite course you have designed?
I think this is where I get in trouble. Well, you get me in trouble. I think for different reasons, Sydney 2000 and Wake 2010 in Kentucky.
Wow.
But I mean, they're all special and they all have different reasons. I mean, the moon I love. I mean, I love Adelaide. I loved Hong Kong. So it goes on. You know. As I say, you get me in trouble. Big trouble.
He's hedging.
Okay.
Sorry if I've offended anybody.
All right. Favorite. Do you have any hobbies outside of horses?
I like skiing. Skiing's good. Anything with a bit of an edge on it is quite good. So skiing. It's always good to get out of control. I like motorbikes as well. Although Sue, I actually sold my last bike, and Sue said if I get another bike now, so it won't go down well. No, I got the biggest Harley I could find.
Really?
On stage.
Oh wow.
Yeah.
How about
that? Yeah.
You can always stash a bike here in the States, you know, so we'll never know.
It's tempting. It's tempting, I have to say. Yeah, it's very tempting.
We got room in our garage. I'll never tell.
Who says I'm too old?
Yeah. Not true.
Okay. Next question. Do you have any eventing pet peeves?
Pet peeves?
Yeah. Anything out there that like irks you with the sport?
People who don't appreciate the volunteers, people who take things for granted.
Yeah,
that's excellent answer.
Yeah, that's an excellent answer.
That's the best answer I think we've ever gotten.
Yeah. Okay. If a movie was made about your life, what actor would you want to play you?
Bloody hell.
I'm the nice one of this group. Karen's the one that throws the zingers out there, the hard stuff, the stuff that'll get you in trouble.
Dear God. That's a good question. I mean, we're inclined to do rather stupid things in our family that are sort of quite risky sometimes. So, somebody like Tom Cruise enjoys doing that, but he's got the looks that I haven't got.
I see Tom Cruise.
I think Tom Cruise could play.
He's got the looks that he's got the bank balance that we haven't got. But I mean, we do a lot of those stupid things that he does, just because it's sort of that attitude. I mean, that's a really tough question. I've never been asked that before. I've been asked all sorts of things before. I've never been asked that. Bloody hell. Or Mr. Bean. Or something like that. No, certainly somebody who's not going to take it too seriously, that's for sure.
Mr. Bean. Oh, my gosh. No, that's a
nothing heavy duty.
That's so funny.
Good question.
All right, last question. Watching, you know, horses run your courses, is there one particular horse that you see out there running your course that you're just like, wow, look at that horse go?
There's a standout. Well, there's all sorts of standouts. I mean, Scotty on Murphy was always impressive and flamboyant. But there's a standout, which I'll always remember, was two standouts. One you touched on already, really, was Karen and Teddy O'Connor. But the standout one was a wet year in Kentucky. I can't remember the year. Anyway, Bruce was riding a little tricky, I think. Bruce Davis, I think he was on a little tricky. Anyway, lots of people were drawing. I mean, because Janie would she'd divide the day. You know, she'd have a certain amount in the morning and a certain amount in the afternoon with a break in the middle because she wanted people to go shopping and that sort of stuff. And the morning was okay in the afternoon, and then it started raining. It was always going to rain at about midday. And so it turned the afternoon into a completely different competition to the morning. And the heavens opened. We knew it was coming. And poured and poured and poured, to the point where actually a lot of people withdrew. And Bruce said, you know what? I don't understand what the problem is. And just went out there and gave a masterclass, absolute masterclass, you know, of how to ride in those conditions. And it was brilliant. It was fantastic to watch. I mean, absolute standout, you know, in horsemanship and experience and showing the youngsters what to do and how to do it. I mean, it was a lesson to be learned for everybody. And it was fantastic. I mean, it's an interesting day. I mean, I went out there and went down to the steeplechase, and everybody was ploughing up the same line. I thought, well, what's wrong with these people? Why don't they just drift out a little bit, get some fresh ground? And, of course, Bruce goes cruising around the fresh ground. No, stand out.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, we're lucky enough in our sport to see many fabulous rounds. It's like Toddy going around Babington with only one stirrup and all that sort of stuff. But something that your audience would probably remember would be Bruce and that one. I mean, that always comes to mind.
Yeah. Always. The guy's awesome.
Yeah.
It doesn't. You don't get a statue in Kentucky Horse Park for nothing, you know?
Yeah, I know, exactly. Exactly. Thoroughly well deserved as well.
Yeah.
You know, the funny thing is, like, we've talked to people, we've seen it. People are getting their picture with the statue while Bruce is 15 feet away watching them. Yeah. It's kind of funny. You got the real deal right there, and they're getting their picture with the statue.
Yeah. No, totally.
That's so funny.
That's a hard one, but I mean, that's definitely a standout. But again, I've been lucky enough through what I've been able to do to see many classic rounds at lower levels and Worlds and Olympics and things over my courses. So it's that jumps out like a flash. Yeah.
Love it. Wow. I love it. Karen.
Well, A++.
A++. We have a new top score.
A++.
Yeah.
Right. A quick one. I'm ahead then.
Yeah. Oh, goodness.
You know, there's no such thing as, well, there is a little bit of thing called luck in this world, but I'm a great believer you make your own luck. And I was really lucky, as I mentioned earlier on, I mean, I got a break when Janie Atkinson in Kentucky, she was the event director there, asked me if I'd come and design the course there in the early 1990s. And it was a fantastic opportunity. That was really my big break on the international scene. And for Janie, I shall always be very grateful for that opportunity. And I got there at the right time. The event was, you know, in its infancy in many ways. Okay, they had the World Championships in 78. But it was just ready to thrive and blossom and grow. And so it was a great opportunity for me. It was in the days of, a lot of people won't remember this one, there was a grass arena there where the stadium was and on grass. And it was, so it's a completely different animal now. But it was fantastic. So, I mean, that was, you know, a really great opportunity for me. And I was very lucky to get that. And as I say, culminated in the World Games in 2010.
Wow. That's amazing. I always believe that, like Sam Watson was just on, he says, there is no such thing as luck, yada, yada. But I do believe that, you know, luck is when opportunity and preparation meet, you know, and for you to be able to say, you get that little opportunity, that little, that little crack in the door opening, and you take it, you know, and you're not afraid and you jump around. I'm sure that was nervous for you. Your first opportunity to do a big one like that, that had been kind of nerve wracking, right?
Well, it's exciting, and I'm with you, actually. I mean, yeah, we all talk about luck, but actually you make your own luck, and, you know, people like me, you know, you absolutely do your best every time you do it, and if you're given an opportunity or a door is just a little bit open, as you say, you've got to push it wide open, and the reality is nice guys don't come second. You know, everybody remembers the guys who win and do well, and underneath all of us who are a little bit competitive, you know, there's a little bit of steel running through us, and you want to get there. It's like, you know, you want to win the race. You don't want to be second. And so, you know, I mean, Sam's right. It's we all talk about luck, but I think that's being generous in some respects. But you still do need lucky breaks every so often. And there's no question. I mean, Janie ringing me up was certainly a lucky break for me, and or a good break. You know, and having got that opportunity, you know, I was going to absolutely make the best of it as I possibly could, for sure.
Yeah, I think it's fantastic. All these years later, you still remember to say thank you to someone who got you started. People should take note of that at home listening. Like, don't forget who gave you those little breaks that set you on your way. So that's fantastic. Thank you, Janie, for bringing us this awesome course designer that went on to do so many great things. It's fantastic. It's amazing. It's amazing how the these little opportunities it was a big opportunity, but you took it and ran with it, and I just think it's fantastic.
Yeah, it was great because, the venue was being developed, as we know, into what it is nowadays. And, the course was very different then, and we had race and chess and steeplechase, so it was a different beast, different animal. And it's great now that international athletes are coming over and supporting it, from Europe, which is fantastic. And, it's tough running these top-level competitions, and the finances are always a worry and a concern. It's, it's no mean feat to put an event on the map and then make it grow. I mean, we've been lucky enough. We started a couple over in the UK here, which have gone on to be big international competitions. And it's tough. It is tough,
Yeah, and we almost lost Kentucky for 2021, but I don't know if you're aware, there was a huge fundraising, effort put in basically a week to raise over $500,000. So we're going to run it, but it is tough, and hopefully everything in Britain can run, and we're just thankful that we're able to get ours in. So,
yeah, that was an amazing effort. Hats off to everybody who rolled the sleeves up and got into it. A huge effort. I'd love to think we could see it happening over here, but there sort of seems to be a more generous type of mentality in the States than there is in this part of the world. But that, maybe I'm being a bit harsh on things over here, but it you guys certainly in your part of the world seem to step up more quickly and more readily, I think, than possibly happens over here. But maybe I'm wrong on that. But that's how, that's the feeling that I have. And but it was fantastic. It's great to see the event continuing. I don't know the ins and outs of it, but it's not for me to know. But the main thing is it's on, and that's great news.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So as we wind things down, do you have any advice for someone wanting to become a course designer?
Roll your sleeves up, build some fences, and ride lots of average horses. Wow. Ride some good ones. Ride some not so good ones as well, and then watch. I spend a lot of time watching horses, watching how horses jump different types of fences, how they cover the ground, how different fences jump. And I do it without anybody yakking in my ear, because that's for me how I learnt a lot, was by riding horses that were not necessarily as gifted as the true world stars, and by watching. Watching.
How about
that? And putting it away in the locker.
Yeah.
I love that.
Great advice.
Keep it simple. Don't try and be too smart. Keep it simple, stupid. The KISS theory.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's you don't have to be smart doing what I'm doing.
If for course designer, I know there's like the training and the courses and things like that, but is it the type of thing where if someone was aspiring to course designer, if they wanted to, kind of be an apprentice, can they say, hey, look, Mike's designing this and this person's designing that? Can they just typically ring up and say, hey, could I somehow
shadow or
help, can I carry your coffee while learn the ropes? Is that possible?
Yeah. It happens quite a lot. I'm sure it happens. It'll happen with all sorts of people, it's not just me. And it's one of the great things about the horse sport, we're all happy to share. People come along. It's fantastic. It can be a little antisocial. I do say to people, I say, look, you need to understand that somebody's paying me to be here. Therefore, I've got to concentrate and I won't necessarily be very communicative. The best thing to do is come along actually when the course is being put together, not in the initial design stages, because otherwise they're just going to hang you around thinking, what's he thinking about? Well, actually, what you're doing is you're mulling over all sorts of things in your head.
Yeah.
Definitely. We're all up for it, and people get a bit nervous about ringing people like me sometimes, which they shouldn't do. If it's something they want to do, then go for it. Nobody bites. We're desperately short of up and coming course designers. The average age of course designers now is getting on a bit. I was lucky enough to do my first 4-star long, as it were, when I was 33 years old. And, you know, those opportunities don't come along very often now. So, no, ask. It's not easy to get into because, I mean, there aren't many courses around the world, obviously. And, you know, you need luck. You're born lucky, really.
And as someone who, like, you're saying rode a lot of horses on that, can someone to design a 5-star course, do you feel that a person's had to have ridden at that level at one time or close to that level? How does that work, do you think?
I do. And the reason I say that is because you're making such fine line decisions. You can overcook a course so easily, and you can undercook it. And the thing that takes time about course design is actually learning what's appropriate for the different levels. Big is not difficult. Small is not easy. You know, it is one of the old maxims. But if an inch here or there can make a huge difference, and if something's, just by dropping something an inch or jacking it up an inch, the impact can be so significant. And you've just got to have that feel. It's feel. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's really tough to die at the top level if you haven't ridden there. I'd almost say it's virtually impossible. When we're talking about top level,
sure,
because you can't afford to get things wrong. We all do get things wrong. It's just a question of how well we disguise them. I mean, we all make mistakes. It's just a question of make sure you learn from those mistakes and try not to make them too obvious. I think to design at the top end is so hard. If you haven't got an understanding of what it's all about, I think you'd be up against it. That's not to say it'll never happen, but it'd be kind of tricky for it to ever happen, I think. Just because of where the sport is, really. I mean, if you'd asked me that many years ago now, I'd think, you might have got away with it, but I don't think you can now. And you know, we're all in this together. I mean, it's a great thing that I bang the drum about is, we're not, and for me, it's really, really important that we're in this, whether you're in a course designer, a grand juror, an athlete, a groom, a horse, whatever, an official of any sort, we're all in the sport together, and we need to work together. And there's never an us and them situation. You know, and nobody has a monopoly on good ideas or better suggestions. So, you know, it's why I like getting feedback from riders. I like getting feedback from people I respect. You can have fences that don't cause any problems, but just don't jump well. And I don't believe in going on statistics. I go by what I see. And just because a fence doesn't cause any problems or cause any penalties doesn't necessarily mean it's jumped well or jumped easily. It can be a dog of a fence, and you very simply move it 3 meters one way or another, suddenly it jumps much better. But I think it's those sort of things. Unless you feel and you can understand it, it's the chances are you're going to come up short unless you've been lucky enough to ride it to a level. It's hard enough as it is. And, you know, we all see situations around the world where riders lose confidence in designers, which is not great. And then designers lose confidence in themselves. You know, they start questioning whether they're doing a good job or not a good job. And I've seen it a little bit, you know, sort of where mentored people and just got them back in a better place mentally because they doubt themselves too much. And doubt is one thing, but, you know, you have to constantly reevaluate what you're doing, but still have confidence that actually what you're doing is good and is the right thing. And I like to think that, you know, if ever I start doing completely the wrong thing, I'll be smart enough to walk away from it and think, you know what, I'm over the top. I'm past my sell by date. And if I didn't realize it, I would hope somebody would tap me on the shoulder and say, Mike, it's time you went and just mowed your lawn and go to the pub.
Go to the pub. Yeah. I'll meet you there.
No, I've been lucky enough to do it. I'm getting on a bit now. It needs a younger generation of course designers to come through. I mean, we're all old farts. That's people who are doing the top end. You know, where's the young blood that's pushing through? And we've been doing it for a while. I mean, somebody said to me the other day, sort of, well, no, a couple of years ago, said, bloody hell, he said, you gave up in 2010 and now you come back and you're getting all the top gigs again. That's, you know, you've got to give us a chance. I said, no. Get better.
Yeah.
There you go.
I said, they're only asking me because there's nobody else. You know, you should be pushing me. You should be doing me out of a job.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Fair point. You know. Which is true. You know, if I get chased out of a job by somebody who's better than me, fantastic. Good for them. Brilliant.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Yeah. I don't know. Well, hopefully, I think we've talked to some writers that have expressed interest in course mm-hmm. design and all. So I think they're still in that competition mode, but we have, had a couple of a number of writers that have said that down the road they want to get into course design. So hopefully they start to dabble in that a little bit. Mm-hmm. You know, just start to get their toe wet. You know, and
good thing to do. I mean, it does require investing a lot of time, and the trouble is, I mean, you know, the pool, the athlete pool, is the obvious pool to fish in. But you know, there's a commitment, and the reality is that athletes can earn an awful lot more money going coaching than they can out of course designing. And you know, the world as it is at the moment, you've got a thumping great mortgage to pay.
Yeah.
You know which way you're going to go. Yeah. And you know, so we have to be realistic about it as well. And the system can make it quite difficult. Quite hard. I mean, I've been lucky enough to work with some people who've worked through the levels and managed to get them on the FEI list. But then there's when they're riding, and so that you can do it, but you've got to be committed. And the system, the FEI system, and some national systems as well, to not put some roadblocks in the way. And actually, what we need to do is we need to encourage these guys and not put roadblocks in the way. They're still going to learn the trade, but let's welcome them into it and not, you know, make life, you know, almost impossible. So it can be a bit treacly, but if you can get lucky breaks, I mean, we all need a lucky break every so often. Mm-hmm. And if you can get a lucky break and it happens to people like what you do, I believe that you'll get going. The beginning, the snowball will grow.
Yeah.
I'm sure of that.
Yeah. Well, you know, we always talk about sustainability for the sport, and definitely having educated quality course designers for the future
very
is
important.
Super important. So we definitely got
it. Well, it is. Exactly. Because, I mean, as we know, I mean, cost is one of the biggest things in the sport. You know, if you haven't got any events, you haven't got any sport. And, you know, in your country, we know that the officials get paid and they get paid well. It's almost a career for some of them. Whereas in the rest of the world, the only people who tend to get paid are the course designers, thankfully. and you know, it makes it really, really difficult for an organizer to balance the books. And if organizers did a true costing on all their costs, I mean, they'd probably pack up and go to the beach, frankly, because it requires such commitment and, you know, huge volunteer base. And I mean, the costs. Very few events make decent money around the world. Very few. Most of the time, it's organizers struggling for a few bob here, a few dollars there. And yeah, it's so hard. I mean, we've done it. I've been there, done it. And, you know, you're relying on levels of sponsorship for viability. And for me, cost is the biggest threat to the sport at the moment. And there's a big discussion also about ethics of horses in sport, but that's a different issue. But it's... I think cost is potentially the biggest threat, because if it keeps going as it is, sooner or later it'll price itself out of the market. So I mean, the sport has to, you know, do something. Mm-hmm. And we're having the same discussions here. It's the same discussions going all around the world. Mm-hmm. And it's important. Also, we need to keep our place in Olympic Games, but that's getting into a very political scenario.
Yeah. Well, now part of our mission at Major League Eventing, on top of, you know, like the podcast and things like this, these are our tools, but our overall mission is to grow the sport. And part of growing the sport is infusing more money into the sport. So that's why we're trying to work with people like the folks at Red Hills and Aiken and Maryland Five Star and Fairhill International. You know, we're our mission is to try to help do that, help to bring more money into the sport so it's sustainable, and that's why we do what we do. So mm-hmm. that's our goal. So as you say that just strikes home with us.
Yeah, no, well done. I mean, it's also important to have variety, you know, because you can have a lot of people come in and, I don't know, build very sexy facilities, which is great, but if you know, if you only end up with, I don't know, half a dozen of those in any one country, which we do see in different parts of the world, you know, that's not going to create the foundations for the sport. You know, that's just tends to be at elite level and it's a bit sanitized. You know, we need the variety and the different events and the different personalities, the different characteristics of the courses, I think. And then we get a much more rounded product in terms of athlete and horse.
Yeah. Well, that sets us apart from straight dressage and pure show jumping, you know, that, I mean, you know, you can set those jumps up in grass or footing in any venue. That's, you know, it's the cross country. That's what gives each, gives our sport that, that unique, the different.
Yeah, exactly. And which is why we all get into it in the first place.
Right.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I love it. Yeah. Oof. Well, Karen, is this fantastic?
This was great.
So before we let Mike go, we'll just mention again, thanks so much to our folks over at Red Hills for helping us get in touch with Mike. And Mike, thank you for your time. Red Hills, while there's no spectators, they are going to be live streamed. So yes, people can see that. That Mike ES course on the live stream.
Oh, yeah.
And yeah, again, that's going to be March 11th. What's that?
I'll be watching it too.
You'll be on the phone. That doesn't look the way I wanted it. So that's March 11th and 14th. They the way the COVID year is, things got a late start for those guys, but they're doing a knockout, just a great job. So, and Karen, was this interview with Mike fantastic?
This was great. Mike, can't wait to finally get to meet you once everything is settled down.
Great chat, guys. Thank you. Yeah. That's been fun. Awesome. And I'll have to think about those questions you asked me. Who to play me in the movie? That's a tricky one.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed today's show. Please subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google, or your favorite podcast app. Cheers.